The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very good morning to you. How are you?
Boker Tov, I'm using another opportunity just for a shout out with your permission, Howard, to cousin Haley, who's celebrating a bat mitzvah tomorrow.
Oh, how wonderful.
I talk to Haley and to the parents and the grandparents. I hope she will continue to be a source of nachat and joy to everybody. And unfortunately, in this COVID age, it's really, really tough to celebrate your bat mitzvah or your bar mitzvah, right?
It really is. And those are the kids that are, I mean, we've spoken a lot about the loss that our kids have endured over the last year and a bit. But I really do feel for the kids who are celebrating bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs. It's very, it's not easy. I mean, I think that they'll look back on it as a very special time in their lives and very different, and they'll always remember that. It'll link them to this time in a different way. But when you're 12 and 13 and you're going through it, it certainly can't be easy.
I certainly hope that within the very near future, we will all be able to look back on this situation in this period to say, who would have believed it? But at the moment, unfortunately, being right in the middle of it, it's kind of hard to find out, to see our way out of it.
Absolutely right. Former President Trump has pardoned Jonathan Pollard, Pollard's handler, on his last day in office. Tell us about this, Anthony.
Well, this is a fascinating story about Aviyem Sela, who was Jonathan Pollard's handler. We know that it is the usual practice of American presidents to grant pardons in their last hours in office, and President Trump certainly took advantage of that opportunity, granting quite a number of pardons yesterday and the day before, just before he left office. But the story of Aviyem Sela is an interesting one, because Jonathan Pollard was originally recruited to his role in this espionage story that we know something about. When Sela and he met at a lecture while Aviyem Sela was studying for his PhD at New York University, and thereafter apparently transpired quite a close relationship, where of course Jonathan Pollard, as we now know, managed to secret a lot of information from the Navy where he was working, the U.S. Navy, to the Israeli intelligence. And apparently Aviyem Sela was one of those key people in the chain. We always thought that Rafi Eitan was the main handler, but it turns out that Aviyem Sela was really in the chain somewhere. And when it came the moment that the story broke out and that Pollard was arrested, a number of Israelis at that stage were granted immunity from prosecution in the U.S. in exchange for cooperation after Pollard was arrested. But because Sela's role was not known at the time, he was not given immunity, and he was indicted by a grand jury to appear on charges that could have carried a life sentence and a $500,000 fine. In the event, of course, he escaped, came back to Israel, he then went on to quite a senior role in the Israeli Air Force. He was a brigadier general. He was commander of one of the major Air Force bases in Israel. And the story suggests that if he had not been involved in this Pollard case, that he might have even gone on to become the head of the Air Force, the commander in charge of the Air Force. Wow. He was a pilot, and he was involved in a number of interesting sorties on behalf of the Israeli Air Force, including a mission which destroyed Soviet-made Syrian surface-to-air missiles in the Bekaa Valley way back in the day during the first Lebanon War. And so he was really involved in a lot of the activities, and most importantly, I think he was probably most importantly, was the commander responsible for planning Operation Opera, which was the operation which saw the destruction of the Iraqi nuclear reactor at Osirak back in 1981. So he's certainly someone with a very, very special career in the Air Force. But of course, he was always held down by this link with Pollard. And in the end, he was put forward to President Trump for clemency, supported by Prime Minister Netanyahu, also supported by the Israeli ambassador to the United States, Ron Dermer, also supported by David Freeman, the former now United States Ambassador to Israel, and of course Dr. Miriam Adelson, whose husband Sheldon unfortunately died last week, but she was also one of those people who put him forward for clemency, and that clemency was granted. So I think that this has just sort of come full circle on the whole Jonathan Pollard story, with Pollard having made Aliyah to Israel over the last month or so, and now with Sella also being granted a pardon, I think that kind of puts the story to bed, at least for now. I wonder whether it might not open up a little bit more about exactly what happened, given that people are now have got away, got over the possibility that they might be prosecuted or that they might be under threat. I just wonder whether it might open up a little bit more of exactly what happened and what transpired, and why it was that the U.S. administration was so intent on keeping Pollard in prison until the very, very last opportunity that they could, in spite of so many attempts and so many requests for him to be released a little bit earlier, or at least sooner than a murderer would be released, which is what he served more time than many murderers in the U.S. serve.
Certainly it was, it just was this incredible bone of contention. So, it is a great thing that this is now, that now seems to be over.
So, I think so. I think it is over for now, but as I've said before, I think there's still a lot to be told about the story, and I'm certainly eager to hear more about it.
Yeah, I would as well. I think it's a great book that is begging to be written. In the hours prior to the inauguration of the U.S. administration, the Israeli government controversially awarded contracts for the construction of over 2,000 new housing units. Why is this construction considered controversial?
Well, I mean, these are all housing units that are being constructed beyond the so-called green line. The green line is a line, just for people to understand, a green line is a notional boundary that was drawn after the 1967 war, whereby the area that is kind of east of the green line was the area that was at that stage under the control of non-Israeli entities. So some of it was under Jordanian control. Southern part was under Egyptian control. That was before 1967. I apologize, not after, but before 1967. And then, of course, during the Six-Day War, a lot of this land was taken control of by the Israeli army, including, most importantly, the east side of the city of Jerusalem. And after the Six-Day War, 1967, Jerusalem was unified, and that green line was effectively ignored at that point. But now, when we have a new U.S. administration, we're back talking about the possibility of discussions with the Palestinians about setting up an independent Palestinian state. There are still people who consider the green line to be the real boundary which should divide a Jewish state from a Palestinian state. And by the way, interestingly enough, it's largely mirrors what the United Nations suggested back in 1947 in the Palestinian partition plan that was presented to the United Nations, which at that stage the Jews accepted, but of course, as we now know, the Arab side did not accept. And so that was then, and this is now. And of course, Israel has taken control of some of that land beyond the green line, and there are settlements that have been built in those areas beyond the green line. And of course, most importantly, the east side of Jerusalem, as I've said before, is also beyond the green line. So every housing unit that's built within the city of Jerusalem that happens to be on the east side of what was then the dividing border is considered controversial. And hence the reason why the Israeli government needs to be very cautious, because from an international point of view, there is a huge amount of criticism each and every time new homes are developed. The Palestinians would come up and say, this is our land that you're building on and you shouldn't be allowed to do so, even if it is within the city of Jerusalem. And of course, the Jews who live there say, well, we need to be allowed to expand where we live and to allow more people to come and live here, because amongst other things, living the cost of housing in those areas is a lot cheaper. Living in the central part of Israel is enormously expensive. Buying homes is a very, very costly thing. And being able to live outside of the city in a slightly quieter environment and with a lower cost of housing is, of course, something that's very desirable for many people. There are, of course, people who consider it a political statement to go and live there rather than because they're looking for a slightly quieter and more rural lifestyle. It's a political statement to try to actually put Jewish roots down on land which could otherwise potentially be taken away from the Jewish state, and hence the controversy. So even when these housing units are built within areas that have already been designated as part of a Jewish establishment, they are considered to be controversial, and hence this has come up again for controversial discussion. Interestingly, a representative from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Deputy Director General for Europe, a lady called Anna Azari, was briefing officials from 17 European countries, and particularly talking about the on Givat HaMatos, which is really part of the city of Jerusalem. It's within the urban area of the city of Jerusalem, but of course on the east side of the city. And her words are as follows: to claim that construction in Israel's capital is akin to settlement activity, that it is akin to settlement activity, is really unfounded. So she is also talking about so-called settlement activity and the possibility of building in land, which is not quite certain in terms of whose ownership really it falls under. But when we talk about construction within the city of Jerusalem, it would be my view that that should really be unequivocal and there should really be no controversy about it. But I have no doubt that the listeners out there have their views about these construction units and the approval, particularly in the hours before the Biden administration took office.
Yeah, very. I'd love to hear their thoughts. Your thoughts on 34519 or 0618951019. I also saw that the embassy Twitter account was taken over yesterday by the new administration, and for just a few moments, it said embassy U.S. embassy representatives of Israel, West Bank, and Gaza, and everybody got a little concerned about that.
Well, I don't know whether it was supposed to be kind of a bad joke of some sort, or whether this represents something that might come up in the future, or whether it was just some hacker who decided to have a little bit of a laugh. But certainly there was a few moments, at least, when the Twitter account represented representatives of Israel, West Bank, and Gaza, the Israeli administration wouldn't be particularly pleased about that label on the embassy here. But that was very quickly taken away, and there seems to have been not much further discussion about it. So I just think that it was a temporary kind of hacker thing that went on in Twitter, and I'm guessing that we're not going to hear too much more about that.
We don't have a lot of time, but more details have emerged about the normalization deals struck between in the Arab countries over the last few months. What details have been released?
Well, there's been quite a lot. I mean, you know, we have heard about the stories of these normalization deals and how they've been struck and who really was responsible for them. And of course, the U.S. administration under Donald Trump is really given most of the credit for being able to bring to bear these agreements. And in fairness, when one reads more of the stories, there are certainly reasons why the U.S. administration should take credit, and in particular, some of the individuals. It seems as if they're Jared Kushner and David Friedman and Avi Berkovich and others from the U.S. administration really did a massive amount of hard work in order to make these agreements come to bear, to bring them to bear. But it seems as if, though, as well, there was a lot of work done on the Israeli side, particularly by the head of the Mossad, Yossi Cohen, who seems to have traveled a lot to these countries and to have spoken to the various leaders. But I think the one critical thing which we see amongst all of the stories of all the countries that so far have entered into these normalization agreements is the link with Saudi Arabia. One cannot underestimate how important the Saudi link is for all of these countries, even though Saudi, of course, is one of the countries that has yet to establish a normalization agreement with Israel. But Saudi Arabia is really the key part of this particular puzzle. And it seems as if, though, the Iranian story has been very influential in convincing the Saudi authorities that normalization with Israel is not only desirable for Saudi itself, but indeed for other Arab countries around the Gulf and elsewhere within the Middle East. And so the whole Saudi link is really underlying everything that's gone on up until now. Very, very fascinating story indeed. And I think we're going to speak a lot more about not only what has been done up until now, but also this Saudi Arabian link and some of the individuals who were in operation behind the scenes.
Fascinating and just amazing to see what is going on. Let's hope it continues. Anthony Reich, thank you as always. I hope you have a fantastic weekend. A Shabbat Shalom. Stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll catch you on Monday morning.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.